Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're continuing today with our expectations series. Having a lot of fun with these, a lot of different analysts coming on today. And one of my favorite people to talk football with of all, Michael Crawford, is on to do today's show. Michael, how you doing? Been forever since it seems like we've done a show.
Yeah, I'm doing good, Ken. Doing really good. It's always fun to come on and talk Ravens football with you. We always end up having great conversation, and I don't think today is going to be any different. So I'm excited. I've kind of been tapping in to a couple of these, listening to a couple of the other in the other shows in this series, and they've been very interesting. And I can hear the passion people have in their voices about the players they discuss.
It's kind of exciting because people get to pick their own players and their own, you know, pair of two. In the end, we had some pairings left and I had to hand those out. But the initial ones, they're all picking them. And you know, people want to talk about Zakobi McLean, Mekhi Polk.
Yep.
And I, you know, this is some players that if that person's passionate about that, that's the person I want discussing it. All right. Well, today we're going to talk about J.K. Dobbins and Malik Harrison, two different players. And I want to remind people the format of this show is to get two disparate players. We're not looking for the same positional group. We're looking to have as many analysts as possible talk about their players within that positional group. And later on, we'll have the how are the Ravens set up at running back or inside linebacker. Those shows will be coming along either right before camp or towards the end of camp. So lots of fun still to be had. But these are just individual expectations pieces that are more focused on the individual player. So we'll start with J.K. Dobbins here, Michael. Why don't you start us off in terms of who Dobbins was when he last played and, you know, kind of what some of your goals are for him in 2022?
Well, I think when we saw him back in 2020, you kind of still had that three-headed monster in the backfield in terms of Mark Ingram, Gus Edwards, and J.K., who had just been drafted, you know, that previous draft. And they sort of slowly incorporated him into the offense the early part of the season there. You know, he probably had a couple of games. I want to say that first five or six games, they were all under like 10 attempts, you know, like 10 or less. But even in those games where he only had a handful of carries, you would see some explosive plays, right? You saw his ability to take, you know, what looked like a run that maybe was going to get you five, maybe even 10, which is still a really good run, but then turn it into like a 20-yarder, you know, or a longer run, that kind of thing. So I think you look at that year, you know, and then kind of in the latter half of the season, his activity level increased and you started to see him get, you know, double-digit carry games and maybe even get a couple passes out of the backfield. And it was just like, you wanted him to touch the ball more, right? You wanted them to find as many ways as they could to get him to touch the ball because you just saw this home run ability every time he had the ball in the hands. And when I say home run, it doesn't necessarily mean a touchdown, but a big play, right? It turned out to be a touchdown 9 times on the ground, right, in terms of rushing touchdowns.
Yeah.
That was in there too. But just, you know, a guy who really had that big play ability. And it was a combination of skills, right? It wasn't just speed. It wasn't just burst. It was contact balance. It was the ability to run through contact and break tackles. It was the ability to create after the catch, you know, if he was catching, you know, kind of a short thing out of the backfield there, like a little swing or out into the flat, to be able to make guys miss in the open field. Same thing with the ball in his hands as a ball carrier, being able to make guys miss. So all of those skills kind of baked into one J.K. Dobbins cake gave us a really exciting glimpse of, you know, what he brought to the run game. And then going into 2021, we're all excited. It's going to be even more than that. They're going to use him more in the passing game. And unfortunately, he has the injury in the preseason game. And, you know, we lost that season. So really excited to get him back healthy and just kind of see him continue on the trajectory that we saw back in 2020.
Just a real bummer, obviously, to lose him. That 2020 season never had over 15 carries in any game the whole year. Yet you still had 200 carry games, rushed for 6.0 yards per carry. He'll probably never do that again. And yet you hope that some of the circumstances are back for this offensive line that could give him a lot of first contact in level 2 and level 3 that he can leverage into some great home run balls. And I think one of the exciting things, there's lots of questions about Tyler Linderbaum, but one thing I don't have a question about is his ability to get to level 2 and make blocks. And I think that'll really help several of the runners. When they run power schemes where they've got a double team starting and Linderbaum's going to level two to make that second block, that's going to be one of the areas he's really good. Another area is leading a screen pass. You don't really need three great screen blockers out of the middle of your line of scrimmage, and the Ravens have a bunch of elephants otherwise on the offensive line. So Linderbaum's going to be leading the pack. But I think with Dobbins and Beatty both being somewhat elusive players after the catch, that a single extra block in level two from Linderbaum would be very valuable to either of them.
Yeah, and as you said, based on what we've seen from him in college at Iowa, he really excels mm-hmm. in that area. I mean, he's going to mm-hmm. be able to get out. He's going to be able to get downfield. He's going to be able to get to blocks and get to players at level two and even further down the field that we probably haven't seen here in a while. I mean, you might be able to recall some Raven centers of the past, but I mean, during the Lamar Jackson era, we haven't really seen them have a guy who can move that way.
Yeah, the line has been built around elephants for a long time. I mean, even when the interior offensive line was the best in the NFL by a wide margin, with Grubbs, Yanda, and Burke all together for that period that they were, they were slower players who were never really quick guys. You know, they've been perfectly happy to have some slower guards on this team for a long time, guys who could still get the job done as pullers, but, you know, just weren't exceptionally quick. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's been a long time since the Ravens have had that kind of quickness, and it'll be exciting to see. But let's go back to Dobbins here, right? In terms of individual things. So the one thing about 2020 is kind of frustrating with Dobbins is that while he had that great year, he kind of had his very worst game in the last game of the season against Buffalo. Dropped a couple balls, was involved in the blocking miscommunication that led to the pressure on the interception that got run back. So there were a couple things in that game. And my understanding was Dobbins was kind of really upset with himself after the game. And one of the veterans went over to him and told him, you know, don't worry about it. Just, you know, come back and get it done next year. But he didn't get that chance. And now it's been a year and a half.
Yeah, he came across in interviews and the things that you heard teammates say about him or coaches as a guy who held himself to an incredibly high standard. I mean, even for a rookie. Like, his mindset was, hey, in those moments, and I think that's why he was particularly disappointed, in the biggest moments, I expect to make those plays. I see myself, it's not about being a rookie and I need time to learn. No, I should be making those plays right now, whatever, you know, my status is in the league. And like you said, you know, he was involved in a couple of plays there where by his own admission, you know, he didn't execute as well as he should have. So, but I think the good thing about that is he also seems like a guy who's not going to go in the tank perpetually. You know, it's not like a demon that's going to stay with him forever.
I hope not. Yeah.
I don't.
I want to respond to what you just said, though, because I think that is such the preferable attitude for any athlete to have, to hold themselves to a very high standard. That's what I think drives Lamar Jackson to get the positional coaching he does during the offseason. I think, you know, the players you can count on to be ready as soon as camp starts, not work themselves into shape, not the other things. They're the guys who hold themselves to that super high standard. I'm glad to hear Dobbins is that guy. I look and my ears perk up immediately when I hear self-congratulatory components of players. It's like, oh, I tied my shoes today. You know, and it used to be this old Jamie Farr commercial where he ate a Mars bar because he tied his shoes. that's what it is anyway. But that's kind of what it sounds like to me when I hear that kind of thing. And Dobbins being very hard on himself and very demanding of his own way is a indication of work ethic and indication of a guy who's going to be ready.
Yeah, and you see that with a lot of let me make sure I use the correct word. You see that with some of their core guys on offense. You mentioned Lamar. We're talking about Dobbins, Mark Andrews. Another guy who's like that, who's, you know, it's almost like anytime I have an opportunity to work, whether it's in a team setting, whether it's off on my own with, you know, private coaching, or in Mark's case, his family, like whatever the situation is, when I have an opportunity to try to work and improve and get better, I'm going to do it. You know, I think you see that in Marlon Humphrey, too. So I think, you know, they've got a core group of guys on offense and defense who seems to have always carried themselves that way. They came into the organization that way. Mm-hmm. Not something they had to grow into. They came with that.
And it's also great that Lamar is a North Star for this team in terms of how you act during the offseason, in terms of getting yourself ready and keeping ready. One thing I was so impressed by, and I've mentioned this already on one other pod, but I'm going to risk it a second time, is that I think it was Bateman I saw who was running routes with Lamar, and Lamar was just throwing, getting his timing down, you know, getting the depth of the throw, engaging that properly. But Bateman was wearing a helmet. And that tells me right away he's taking that more seriously because he wants to replicate game conditions in terms of vision, in terms of, you know, getting used to catching the ball over either shoulder with a helmet, that sort of thing. Very impressed by that.
Yeah. Yeah. He's another guy. I'm glad you mentioned it. He's another guy that seems to have come in with that same mindset and holding himself to that same standard. And look, you get enough of those guys together on a team and it's contagious. You know, that attitude becomes contagious. Well, it either becomes contagious or you won't be here. If you don't adapt that same attitude, or maybe you're here and you don't play as much, you know, whatever the case may be. But I think that kind of thing, especially from the leaders on the team, is really exactly what you want. You know, you hit on that point. That's exactly what you want out of these guys. And so Dobbins is, you know, bringing it back to Dobbins. Dobbins is one of those guys, in my opinion. I think he came in that way, even as a rookie. I think you'll get to see that again this year, you know, when he's, you know, sort of back around the team and sort of working with the team on a regular basis. It's a little bit different when guys are coming back and they're kind of off to the side and doing some individual stuff. But once they're back ingratiated into the team periods and really incorporated, I should say, into those team periods, then I think you start to see them feel like, okay, I'm back a part of the team again. I mean, they're always a part, but you always hear these guys talk about when they get injured, like you kind of feel like you're not a part of the team while you're injured and you're working your way back. So I think once he's able to kind of really participate fully in practice again, and then obviously in the games, you'll see that leadership and you'll see that performance, which is, you know, really what we're talking about today, come back.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk some goals for 2022. I'll start us off for one. Maybe we just alternate here. I hope he is returning to an offensive line, which is again, built to run the football effectively, barring injuries, you know, obviously the biggest thing involving the Ravens offensive line among all things, more important than Linderbaum, more important than how Fa'alele develops is what's actually going on with Ronnie Stanley. So if that returns to normal, if he's, you know, playing the way he was, this should be a team that's built around the football very effectively. I think they have the speed weapons back that they didn't have last year to threaten the outside. And in terms of Dobbins, I'm hoping that he makes the most out of level two and level three first contact opportunities. That's really where he's best. Gus Edwards can, gets a lot of yards after contact, including some at level one. But in terms of Dobbins, really need to get him through some open holes and get a chance to make a guy miss in level two or level three, or to deflect contact, as you mentioned, with that great contact balance.
Yeah, his rookie season, when you think back, and, you know, even if you just look at numbers, you know, for people who just kind of want to look at that part of it, and these might be a little bit off because they don't account for penalties and stuff like that, but I mean, 134 carries, 805 yards, 9 TDs as a rookie in a committee backfield is pretty impressive. So for me, going into 2021, I'm thinking, okay, this guy's going to run for 1,000, you know, as my baseline. I'm setting 1,000 yards as my baseline. I kind of now go into 2022 expecting the same thing. But again, like you said, there's sort of some qualifications, things that have to happen first. You're expecting the offensive line, particularly Ronnie Stanley, as you mentioned, to get back to form. And you're also expecting Dobbins to get back to form.
Sure.
It's probably unfair of me to say, well, he was going to go into 2021 at this level. I expect him to do the same thing. And well, he's coming off a major injury. So it's probably unfair of me to expect that. But if he is fully recovered, and guys tend to recover from these things, you know, amazingly in this day and age. So if that's there, then yeah, I expect him to be able to do all of those things and then more, because think again, his rookie season, that's all learning. He's seen this at the NFL level for the first time, right? And so now he's got that season under his belt. Yes, he missed last year, but you know, I'd imagine that he's still involved, at least in terms of meetings and that kind of thing. So there's still a mental component going on there. And so now you've got that coming into this 2022 season. And again, like I said, if you're fully healthy, Now you've got that experience to add to your physical, your natural physical gifts and abilities. And I really expect him to do extremely well.
All right. Give us another goal for you for 2022 for him.
I think I'm probably going to go in the receiving area because I know that was something that they really kind of talked a lot going into 2021 during the preseason. They wanted to have him be a bigger part of the passing game. So I don't know if under Greg Roman's offense, you're going to have a ton of like splitting guys out and guys running like receiver type routes. I mean, you have a little bit of that for sure. They motion guys out from time to time, but I think a lot of it kind of comes out of the backfield. But, you know, if he can be a 30-40 catch guy, you know, maybe pick you up 300-400 yards, maybe a couple of touchdowns, you know, as a receiver, and that might be ambitious. Those are probably pretty ambitious numbers. But, you know, if you could add that, then you're talking about one of the top running backs in the game. I mean, not just as a runner, but also as a pass catcher.
I'm trying to stay away from specific numbers predictions and stay with qualitative. And one of the reasons is the Ravens offense, there are so many different people sucking at various nipples for opportunity here that there's not enough ball. There's not enough footballs to go around. I mean, there just aren't. So some receivers are going to come in way under targeted, and it's not just necessarily because of injuries. And in Dobbins' case, he may be one of them in terms of the thing. He did not have a particularly good rookie year as a receiver. And I just want to point this out that whether you look at PFR, PFF, he either had 24 or 25 targets, 18 receptions, and he had 6 drops. And that is not going to get it done. So his yards per target, way down there at 5 yards per target. You don't want that, even from a running back, that's really not acceptable. He needs to cutting down the drops would be a lot, would fix a lot of it. That would get him up into about the 6.7 range again. But that even that is not really great. So, you know, I'm hoping Linderbaum helps him just the way I expect him to help Beatty as well in terms of making that extra level 2 or level 3 block for him that's going to help him break a play or two. I'm also hoping they'll use him some down the field. You know, hey, Dobbins is a guy who can run an effective wheel route, and you don't always expect that. And when you've got that coverage, you know, from a linebacker, that's an opportunity, and you got to take that some. You also, if we're back to an offense where we're not threatening the outside of the field the same way the Ravens have in past years, that's one way to do it. So it's a good way to just stretch the defense in a different way, see if you can get them to make some mistakes.
Yeah, and I could maybe see him. I mean, these guys were at totally different points in their careers, but maybe something along the lines of Mark Ingram in terms of his effect in the passing game. Obviously, in 2020, with the rise of JK in terms of playing time, you know, Mark kind of receded a little bit. But if you go back to 2019, not like he caught a ton of balls or anything like that. But, you know, if you see something along that spectrum, just a guy who can be not only an effective check down option, but can get out and can run a route down the field. I don't think they did it a ton with Mark Ingram that year. I mean, I can picture a couple passes, that kind of little angle route out of the backfield where you start out headed towards the sideline at 45 degrees. Mm-hmm. Break back in. I think he had maybe one down the side. I really remember that one because I think it was against Arizona. We had one down the sideline. It was about a 20-yard catch. It was one of those hole shots in cover two where you have to get it behind the corner and in front of the safety to that side of the field. So maybe some of that.
Hey, this is interesting because Mark Ingram came to Baltimore in 2019 and he had a terrible career with the Saints at 5.6 yards per target, had never been over 6.8 his entire career. 2019, 8.5. with Jackson. So he made some good plays down the field. I think some of what happened with Jackson is since they don't really run the offense the same way the Ravens did with Flacco. Okay, that's obvious. But Flacco always had Ray Rice as a check down. And Ray Rice, in fact, one year had more yak than receiving yards, which means his average ADOT was negative. Yeah. Was behind the line of scrimmage. So, you know, the Ravens don't have normal outlet receiving back the same way because they like to keep the underneath clear for potential Jackson scrambles if they get that opportunity. So he's kind of the check down receiver that they have. So anyway, that creates some longer shots and JK just didn't get a lot of them. Gus Edwards actually did better on some longer passes this in 20 than he did.
Yeah. Yeah, Gus had one long one, I remember, like against the Giants or something, like way down
the middle of the field, like over 30 yards or so, right? Yeah. I'll toss in another one. I had improve as a receiver too. That was important to me, but I wanted to see him running the stretch and cut back effectively when they're doing zone runs. The Ravens need that back as part of the offense. The Elder Statesman last year, they couldn't really do either of these. They were pretty much specifically power runners. And I defer to your run game charting on this, but the very limited amount that the Ravens even ran off tackle was pretty tight to the tackle, like C-gap runs with Freeman, really more than anything else. But you tell me, I know you chart all these plays. What did you see? How much was the Ravens' amount of stretch runs reduced by who they had last year?
Yeah, I would have to pull the charting up to get like specific numbers, but you know, anecdotally, no, you're right. I mean, that was obvious. I mean, I think even people just watching the games could attest to that. And the charting that I did really kind of backed that up. I think as they were trying to learn what they had with this collection of veteran running backs, it became pretty apparent that Freeman was the only one who gave you even a little bit of an opportunity to get to the perimeter, right? The Lev Bell experiment just by and large didn't work. Latavius Murray was pretty much I should limit him to A gap to A gap. I'll give him B gap to B gap. Pretty much an interior from a, you know, guard to guard kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And Freeman, to some extent, I think what Freeman had that those other guys didn't have was a little bit more wiggle, a little bit more make you miss. So if he did get to the perimeter, it's not like he was necessarily going to turn a corner and beat you with speed, but he might be able to make a cut. He might be able to run through some contact and kind of get the corner that way and get the edge. But just by design, no, those plays just weren't nearly as successful. And the volume wasn't there either, just in terms of calling the same amount of plays in terms of volume that were designed to attack the C-gap and designed to attack the edge. Because I think we watched the games, they watched the film, they know more football than we'll ever could ever possibly hope to know. And I think they said, hey, well, what we've got, we're going to have to adjust that. We just don't have the ball carriers who can attack that part of the field in the same way. And I think that's why some people were like clamoring for Duvernay to get more like jet sweeps or more, you know, kind of quick bubbles and stuff like that. Just different ways to attack the perimeter, since you knew or you had accepted the fact that we really can't do it with our ball carriers.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping that Duvernay would be used out of sidecar, because he was the one guy who really had the speed, I thought. And they did use him in that way for one carry.
A little bit.
Okay, and I don't know if there were mesh point concerns with him or whatever, because you know, when you're desperate, all options are on the table, and it wasn't like they were using Duvernay to do so much else within the offense, especially in terms of targets, that would have been an unreasonable use of him for 5-6 carries a game.
Yeah, that's true. That was a tricky one for me to figure out. I probably was a little bit more in the minority in terms of how much they should have done that with him, but I still wanted them to do it more than they did. Like, you know, you can get into, you can pick nits about, well, should he have gotten, you know, 5 of those carries or 3 of those? I don't want to get into all of that. Mm-hmm. Just conceptually, I agreed that, hey, let's use a guy who not only has the speed, but really kind of has the running style to execute some of those concepts. I mean, he's sort of built like a running back just in terms of body type. And he has that very linear north-south kind of style, but he's also got the speed to outrun guys laterally, you know? So you're thinking, all right, he's going to be able to get the edge against pretty much anybody unless they already have him out-leveraged, you know? And there's maybe another, you know, sometimes like what they do with Lamar, right? They've got like 2 guys out there to try to get him from getting in the corner. So unless you have that, and so maybe they felt like the threat wasn't there per se. You know, I'd have to go back and look at those games to say, okay, well, why wouldn't we even try it more? Were defenses playing
or threaten it more?
Yeah. Were defenses playing you in such a way where you felt like you never got the look you wanted to run those plays? Because, like you said, they did some of those things. If it wasn't necessarily a handoff, there were bubble screens and quick screens and things like, which is just an extension of the run game. It's not really a pass. I mean, technically it's a pass, but it's an extension of the run game. But I thought they could have even done those more.
They used him a fair amount in jet motion, but what you know, it would be one thing if they motioned out of the look because they didn't get the look defensively that they were going for. So if they line him up in sidecar coming to the line of scrimmage and then, you know, check and he's all of a sudden he's off in the slot, but they didn't do that. I mean, you know, they never really gave him that chance to line up in the backfield. Anyway, enough about Duvernay. Let's get back to Dobbins here for a second. Another thing on my list is that the pass blocking I want to see, not progress is not the right word. I want to see him be at least as good as he was as a pass blocker in 2020. That may surprise some people because, you know, the season ended how it did. I think there is a limit to how much he can give you in that role. And if he can give you a slightly above average level of play as a pass blocker, where he then is also a guy who can release late, I think that could be very valuable to Lamar.
Yeah. What's interesting about that Bills play, I don't want to like totally derail us with it, but it's just because I remember really digging into it because, of course, people were losing their minds about that. If you look, I want to say it was as little as two plays before. He had that exact same block, that exact same concept where he's executing a fake and then he's blocking the defensive end and executed it perfectly. Now, a couple things that were different. Different guy. It wasn't Jerry Hughes on the two plays before. It was a guy who wasn't quite as athletic. And so, you know, he's attempting to cut that guy, right, and give, you know, Lamar an opportunity to make a throw. He tried to cut Jerry Hughes, and Jerry Hughes danced around him. He's a much more athletic guy. And I think there was also a different alignment look that the Bills used on the play where, you know, the block wasn't executed. I think there were two guys outside the tackle instead of one guy kind of on the edge of the tackle. So there was a couple different things that went into that. But he wouldn't make that excuse, right? He would say, hey, I got to make that block. I'm supposed to make that block in that situation. So, you know, for me, that's kind of how I feel about the pass pro with him. I think it sounds like you sort of see it similarly to me. Like the willingness is not an issue and the ability is not an issue, right? But I think so there's two parts to it. I think willingness and ability can be an issue for running backs coming into the NFL with pass pro. Yep. It depends on the player, of course. So that can be one part of the challenge. The other part is knowing who to block. That's typically the bigger one. I think a lot of these guys do kind of have the willingness and the desire, although there are some, you question it, but I think a lot of them have it. But knowing who to block in each situation and as that situation evolves, right? Because you may know it up on the board statically during the week, but then you get in the game and the pieces are moving. And it's like, all right, I was supposed to block that guy, but now that they've moved, who do I block now?
Yeah, and that recognition affects where he takes his set. And I mean, it affects everything. He's got to be quick making that recognition to get up to a point where he actually makes a useful block. And one thing you notice is kind of a common trait in bad pass blocking running backs is that they wait too long or they diagnose too late. And then they block, you know, a 2 feet in front of the quarterback. I mean, the cone has already been compromised. You know, that quarterback's got to move to throw. You know, he can't step into his throw. All the bad things you don't want. You know, it is difficult. I mean, hey, you know, blocking as a running back is complex. It's at least as complex, I think, as blocking at center, where you have to try and pick up that stunt or that second guy coming through, you know, off of your double team and make maybe a difficult reach for yourself. I think as a running back, you know, you've got what, 180 degrees you got to be looking for almost that you got to be looking for a potential pass rusher.
Absolutely. And this, I think it's a pretty high standard, even though the guy, when he was here, he didn't play that many actual snaps. But Danny Woodhead is kind of the guy that I look for, like running back.
One series. Yeah.
Yeah. Because even though, and you can, you know, so you can look beyond the Ravens if you want to look at the other places that he'd been in his career, you saw that as a consistent thing. Not the biggest guy by any stretch of the imagination, but he knew who to block. And I think that really helped him become an effective pass blocker because he could get there and get into position quickly, right? Before the defender really had a chance to take advantage of the mismatch, because oftentimes it was a physical mismatch. But Danny knew who to block and where to block. And I think he was really effective because of it.
Important part of positional coaching for running backs and something they should be looking at is, look, hey, if I'm a good pass blocker, that immediately is going to increase my receiving opportunities and the money I'm going to make in this game. I mean, it's so central. The other thing we've seen in the NFL for years, and this goes back to my youth in the 70s and whatnot, guys would hang around the NFL for seems like an extra decade sometimes. It's not quite that long, obviously, as running backs because they could catch the football and pass block effectively. So you had all these, you know, Larry Centers and Don McCauley was one of these for the Colts, and all these guys who basically were third down specialists. And, you know, you brought them in because they understood their responsibilities there and they could also catch the football a little bit.
We heard Greg Roman comment on this in that Ravens Wired piece about the rookie minicamp. He's talking to Tyler Batty and he says, hey, can you have your pass pro? And he's like, oh, it's good. I'm good. He's like, yeah, because we can't put you on the field and you not know who to block and you get our quarterback killed. So
it better there you go. All right, give me one more goal for Dobbins for this year.
Well, let's see. We talked about some things as a runner. We talked about pass pro, talked about some things as a receiver. I guess this is sort of an intangible, but because we've kind of touched on it throughout all of these different segments of his game, kind of answering that bell in those big moments, right? Mm-hmm. That people call it different things, clutch, grit, you know, whatever you want to call it, but kind of answer, you know, you want to be that player. You say you want to be that player. You expect yourself to be that player. Okay, in those moments, be that player. I need you to be that player and to be able to do it consistently. Doesn't mean you're going to be perfect every time. You know, mistakes happen. These guys are humans, obviously. But in those big moments, when they need that play to be made, whether it's a block, whether it's the catch, whether it's a run, whatever it is, you know, I need you to be that guy and not almost be that. I heard a coach talk about that before. He said, look, we want and guys, not but guys, right? I want and can run a guy over or make a guy miss. I don't want the guy who makes the catch, but he fumbled it. He got stripped. Yeah. I don't need but guys. I need and.
I love that. It's just like improv, you know, it's a good way to put it. I would like to see a little bit of a connection with Lamar in terms of extended plays. And by that, I mean that Dobbins is a guy who figures out how to go to not the place you go by rule under those situations. So Andrews and Lamar are hive mind on that. But Dobbins could be a guy who finds space in the middle of the field, even though Lamar is rolling right and all the rules of football tell you don't throw back about across your body. Well, those rules don't apply to Lamar. And he needs to find space for a receiver somewhere because of the gravitational effect he has on all the other 11 defenders. So we've seen him make play after play back to the middle of the field deep, but they usually go away from the normal rules of this guy goes immediately to the sideline at 10 yards and this guy comes back to the quarterback as close as possible and this guy goes deep down that right sideline. But you don't want everybody gravitating to the right sideline just because Lamar's rolling in that direction.
Absolutely not. I would love to see that. I don't know how you replicate the kind of chemistry or whatever word you want to describe that he has with Andrews, because both of them do not operate within convention. Yeah. You know, I'm sure they're coached to do certain things and they do those things. I'm not going to say they never, you know, adhere to coaching, but when you have to improvise, when the play breaks down, there's something about those two. And I guess they see the field the same way. They see defenses the same way. I don't know what it is, but the way that they improv, they're in sync. Whereas everybody else, like you said, they're kind of, okay, well, here's the scramble rule. I go here. And then the guy above me, he's going to go here. Andrews is doing whatever the hell he wants. And it happens to be on the same page. And you know, I say that people are like, well, no, how can these guys just do whatever they want? Hey, listen to the defenders. Listen to Chuck Clark. Chuck Clark talked about this during a press conference. They asked him what he thought made Mark Andrews so good. He's like, he can do whatever he wants. And they started laughing. He's like, no, literally, he can do whatever he wants. I have to stay within the route that is going. He's just like, that's all I'm going to say about it. So, and you can see that on the field. And I think when people talk about their spacing issues, I think that's some component of it is Mark has the green light to kind of go where he thinks he needs to go to get open. And sometimes that's going to be great. And it's going to lead to explosive plays. And you never, ever want to you never want to coach that out of him. For the, you know, to try to offset the times where guys kind of get in the same area and it looks like a cluster, you know what? I'll take those. I will absolutely take those.
It'd be like trying to coach Ed Reed not to gamble, or try to coach Marcus Peters in today's game not to gamble. I mean, that'd be ridiculous. You know, the guy understands the game and space and whatnot, and in a way that, you know, is you can't coach. I mean, you just cannot coach it. You know, as nearly as well as he can do it in terms of what he does. Boy, I. You know, a lot was made of that, you know, years ago in terms of how baseball players would take their stances, and Cal Ripken just would change his stance seemingly every week in terms of how he's doing things. Rod Carew did whatever was comfortable at the time, moved his stance around. And I'm not saying those two hitters are equivalent or anything, but I'm saying, you know, when you have a good hitter, just let them do their thing and they'll figure it out on their own.
Absolutely. Those ability stance, whatever you're able to do in terms of getting into a stance or exit, as long as you can execute what needs to be executed, then get into whatever you need to get into.
Yep. We have the segment now where we go to talk about what would be a good year and what would be a great year. And I'm going to go ahead and start it here, and you tack on, change it, do whatever you want. Here's my good year for J.K. Dobbins. I want him to return healthy no later than week four. Now, there is always a possibility he's not going to be back, and I include in that the possibility of his play time being ramped up until week four. It's kind of at a normal level. So that would be included in that, and approaches his 2020 rate stats. I don't believe he'll ever run for 6.0 yards per carry again, but I also don't believe he'll ever be at 5.0 yards per target again. So I expect that to improve. So overall, I want his rate stats to be similar. I want him to make noticeable contributions as a receiver, despite the fact the role is shared multiple ways as a runner as well. I would want to know that his own play style has not been compromised by the injury, such that he can still threaten the outside. So the Ravens, again, stress defenses horizontally in the way that it was most successful in 19 and 20.
Yeah, I can't add anything to that. That's the kind of year that I would love to see.
Have I been too tough on him for a good year? Or is most of that a great year? Because I'm going to tell you what I want in terms of a great year here, and that's going to be even more.
No, I don't think so, because I got to imagine the great year is going to exceed all of those areas.
It's going to exceed some. I'm going to say he starts the season healthy and essentially loses nothing from his 2020 season. A little less yards per carry, I am expecting, but better yards per target. And his play demands a bigger share of the snaps than the others. I don't think that's a given now. I think they probably want to use Gus Edwards as the power back. They probably want to use Beatty as a receiving back. And if Dobbins immediately says, well, wait a minute, hold on there, folks. I'm going to start getting 50% of the carries, and I'm going to start getting 50% of the receiving targets for running backs, then I think that would be also probably a good thing. I mean, we won't see nothing from those other players, but Dobbins is the one with the physical tools probably to do the most in that role. Not necessarily more than Beatty, but probably more than Gus as a receiver if he really turns it on properly.
Yeah, I mean, I would qualify that as a great year, and that's what you would want him to do, though. You would want him to make the kind of plays with the ball in his hands, whether that is taking a handoff, whether that is catching the ball out of the backfield or down the field, where he demands that percentage of the work. It's like he's making so many plays, we can't reduce him, and his opportunities to touch the ball. If anything, we want to give him more, right? That's, coaches always talk about good problems. That's a good problem to have. You've got these other talented players in Gus Edwards and Beatty or whoever else they may have, in the backfield. But, Dobbins is playing at such a high level that he demands the lion's share of the touches in that group. So you'd love to have that problem. And to me, if that's happening, then he is making those kinds of plays, and that is a great.
All right, so Dobbins had 134 carries in his rookie season. I don't like to do the numbers again, but what is a great share for him in terms of the number of carries he would get, say, this year?
Oh, well, let's see. Back then in 2020, what did he probably have? Now, I got the first half of the year, we might not want to use that because that's skewed, obviously. Mm-hmm. The second half of the year, where maybe he was getting 12, 13, 14 carries, he was probably still, 30% of the touches, maybe? 30, 40?
Might have been higher than that. Might have been only that. I'd have to go back, honestly.
I think 50. When you threw out that 50% number, anywhere in that 45 to 50 plus. I mean, if you get up to 60, I don't know that that's the way that they necessarily want, their running back dispersal to happen. I think they want to have different guys involved, but 50% would be, to me, that would be a clear indication that he's playing at a really high level.
Yeah. All right. Outstanding. Let's move on. Let's talk about Malik Harrison a little bit, a guy who we probably won't take 38 minutes to talk about here. We'll take a little bit less time, but it is Michael and me, and we love talking football, so you never know. Malik, I'm just going to talk a little bit about where he's coming from. He lost his second season a little bit. There may have been a doghouse component to that. The reason I say that is he only had one snap defensively after week seven, despite the fact that Bynes gave up rotational defensive series to both Welch and Joe Thomas.
Yeah.
So that tells you something about what's going on, because Harrison's available. Yeah. Presumably he's still practicing as an inside linebacker, though there's talk about him playing on the outside and whatnot. He's certainly playing special teams, but he wasn't getting a shot at inside linebacker.
Yeah, that was eye-opening to me. I remember that game in particular, and I'm thinking, okay, there was speculation before, like, okay, maybe he's in the doghouse, or maybe it's this, maybe it's that. If you're getting Joe Thomas is getting snaps over you, then you're not in a good position. I mean, Christian Welch had kind of been mixing in a little bit before that, I think. So with that, you could make a case, right? You could rationalize it to yourself. Maybe it's not a doghouse thing, but when it was Joe Thomas, it's like, okay, this guy's not going to see the field in terms of a defensive snap the rest of the season. He's only going to play special teams. And that's what ended up happening. I believe after the bye week, right? I think when he got shot over the bye week, and I think some of it was related to that, you know, having to be healthy enough, you know, to practice in any capacity. And then I don't know that once he was, I don't know if he played another defensive snap.
He played one defensive snap after week 7.
There you go. Whatever the reasoning was, and I think we talked about this on a previous show where, you know, it was the decision-making component in there. I don't know that he was necessarily doing anything specifically that he shouldn't have been doing, but the reports, you know, he was at a club, a fight broke out in the club, they dispersed everybody out into the streets, he's hanging out in the streets with a group, somebody starts shooting, he gets shot. And so it's one of those things that I think you talked about back during that show, like, hey, from a decision-making standpoint, how about let's not be there? Let's not be in that situation, right? Nobody's saying that you specifically did something that you shouldn't have done, but just from a maturity, professionalism standpoint, maybe that's not a place you need to be. And go ahead.
This is one of these places where his response to it, I would guess, is very important to John Harbaugh based on what I've heard over the years about somebody coming off the field after a fumble, say. If he had come in and said, Coach, I made a huge mistake here. This will never happen again. In terms of how I'm going to make changes to my life, I'm going to say I'm not hanging out with Y and Z because they always have their friends show up. So they're out of my group of friends right now. And I can't go out clubbing other than maybe one night a week in a local place where everybody knows me. I'm not doing any more of that during the season. I'm not putting my teammates in this kind of risk. If he had come with that kind of thing, his agent could have advised him on how to approach this. I think the doghousing would either not have been as long or not have been at all. But if he came in and said, oh, crap, Coach, you wouldn't believe the turd who shot me over here. You know, he's out there shooting. I'm minding my own business. I had nothing to do with this. I mean, as soon as he says that, Harbaugh should be incensed about, you know, the notion of, you know, you mean you take no responsibility for being there in a bad place where people might have guns? You know, it is, he does have a level of culpability for what happened, whether or not he pulled the trigger or, you know, it's a decision-making problem.
Yeah. And on top of that, to add to that, you've got that concern. And then, you know, quite frankly, you're being outplayed on the field. I mean, Josh Bynes is outplaying you on the field. Cause even when he was in there getting defensive snaps, you know, he was lost at times. He looked lost in there at times. And look, I understand he was going into his second year, and we've been down this road with Patrick Queen. Same thing, kind of the early part of the season. The head was still spinning quite a bit, and it looked that way on a lot of plays. And then as Bynes started to play more, things started to settle down. Obviously, Bynes was going to make the plays that he's always made, but he had that settling effect on Patrick Queen. And I think also, you know, the strategic move of allowing Queen to play more on the weak side than it Mike obviously helped him to more natural position for him. But, you know, focusing on Harrison, when you've got a guy who can play both positions, right, both Mike and Will, but I guess, you know, Bynes is probably playing a little bit more at Mike, with his experience, with his ability to get everyone around him set up and in the right place, he was still making plays for himself as well as setting up other people to make plays with just his knowledge. That's going to, and then you're not playing well and you're maybe doing some things off the field that causes some concern. It's going to be hard to keep those snaps.
Yeah. And when there were snaps at a lot, he didn't get them. One of the things about Bynes' play that really sparked Queen, I think, is Queen just never really seemed to trust his own reads. He has some other physicality issues that I think also play into this, but he works extremely well off Bynes' reads. And Bynes has great play speed, despite the fact that he, you know, ran a 4.840 a decade ago, as I always say. Is that really helped Queen to be the trailing man to the football in those situations. But of course, that meant, and with Queen's uptick in play that happened, you know, midseason for a number of weeks there, Harrison was out of a job on the weak side too, where all of his, not all, but a lot of his previous play had occurred.
Yeah, you know what it reminded me of? This is a different situation because we're talking about two players versus one player, but it really reminded me of that year with CJ and Peanut and Kenny Young. The good yep. that they had when CJ yep. was before he left, they were able to play off of CJ, and it allowed mm-hmm. those guys to do, you know, very defined things.
It's a great right? point.
Go hit this gap, go do this, go do that. And those guys played really well in those very defined things that they were being asked to do. Now, when they had to read more broadly and diagnose, you know, in terms of a bigger picture of what the offense was presenting and doing, they struggled. We saw that the next season. They struggled mightily with doing that. So everybody can't do that. One thing I've always wondered about Patrick Queen, I would love, I mean, this would almost be like some kind of sci-fi thing. I don't know if you can even actually do this, but if there was some way to put some kind of sensor on his eyes and monitor where his eyes yeah. go, because I bet they're going all over the place, right? Instead of being really mm-hmm. focused on maybe one or two or three keys. Sometimes they talk about the triangle, right? The running back, mm-hmm. center, and the guard to your side. I bet almost any amount of money when he's kind of out there and it looks like he's out of position, his eyes are going all over the place and he's just right. seeing too much, right? Lou Tepper used to talk about that. He'd say, look, see a little, see a lot, see nothing. That's what he used to tell linebackers all the time.
That's a great way to say it. And I'm not sure, because I think for quarterbacks, they kind of use a different method to initially acquire the field, at least before you go into a read progression. You know, you kind of want to treat the whole field like an easy eye puzzle and, you know, broaden your focus as much as possible, see how that field is developing and see if you can detect how those coverages are doing, and then go through your read progressions. We're only talking about a second here that you have to, you know, to change from A to B here. But I would think, if you're really looking for a lot of keys, that might be useful to a linebacker. So it's interesting to hear this linebacker's coach say, see a lot, see nothing.
Yeah.
There are a lot of keys to read between what offensive linemen are doing, how they're, you know, where their helmets are relative to the defensive linemen, you know, which gap is going to be then open, how it looks like the fullback setting up, is the quarterback really going to hand off the ball? And I mean, you got a lot to read.
It becomes paralysis by analysis because you're reading yeah. too much and you can't react to any one thing in the way that yeah. you need to.
Yeah. No, that's good. That's a great thought. I you know, certainly not something I thought about. How about some goals for Malik Harrison for this year?
Well, I mean, man, if you can just kind of get back in the good graces, I imagine the coaching staff would be the first place that I would want to start. Hey, coach, can we kind of just come in with a clean slate on this thing? Look, I accept everything that happened last year, and I'm going to do everything in my power not to put myself in those positions again. And in terms of on the field with the team, you're going to get the guy that you thought you were getting when you drafted. You know, I'm going to go back out there. I'm going to compete every day. I'll do whatever you ask me to do, whether it's linebacker, whether it's outside linebacker, special teams, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, just come in with that kind of really positive attitude. Just put your nose to the grindstone and just work and see where things go. You know, none of this is guaranteed. You don't know how this is going to play out. They obviously, you know, signed a couple of undrafted inside linebackers or guys who can play a variety of linebacker mm-hmm. spots. So who knows? But I think with him, with his physical profile and with his draft pedigree, you know, he's probably got a little bit of an advantage, I would hope. But it all depends on that relationship with the coaching staff. But come in with that attitude, I think you give yourself a shot.
It's year three for him. So he's getting close to the bubble. He's probably not there. Tyree Phillips is a third round draft pick, also same draft. You know, he's in some danger. Both of them probably end up making the team, but if there is a UDFA linebacker, it's an opportunity to reset the clock, and you got to look at that as sunk cost. They did not tolerate Tim Williams for the entire 4 years, so you know, Harbaugh has a record of getting rid of some guys who've been a pain in the ass for him. You know, as he's going through. Now, I'm not sure. I'm probably overstating how Malik has been a pain in the ass. I really don't know him as a practice player what he does. He plays special teams. So, you know, that's an extra role. One thing I would like to see is that they, to kind of focus his positional, defensive positional role this year. So he's always going to have that special team role. There's extra meetings for that. But if he's going to play weak side, let's play weak side. If he's going to play at the mic and they're really going to make an effort to have him be the guy who will jump in for Bynes if anything happens, then that's fine too. But having one role is probably a good thing. I do see this team doing a ton of platooning at both linebacker spots. So I think this is an opportunity for to have a year where the role at either spot is kind of narrowly defined, and he can really learn those positional skills that he needs to become an effective player.
What do you think about this idea of him playing either one of the outside linebacker positions? I know why people think about it, because you look at him physically, look at his body type. You say he's 6'5", 250, 245, 250-ish. So physically, he looks like a guy who can do it. And he's done some of it, even for the Ravens. Mm-hmm. He did some at Ohio State. He's done a little bit for the Ravens. But, you know,
now, just to be clear, we're talking about like two or four snaps where he's played outside linebacker in his Ravens career.
Yeah, it's very limited. Literally a little bit. But, you know, you hear this narrative that people think, well, maybe he can do a little bit more of that. What do you think about that?
I'm opposed to it. I think first of all, I think all of it risks him developmentally. I think the Ravens' greater need is to develop an inside linebacker who can actually play, as opposed to another outside linebacker where they have some choices. I mean, Dalen Hayes is a terrific, you know, opportunity for development that I really hope the Ravens take. And then they've, you know, they presumably they're going to get Justin Houston back. We're all assuming that at this point. We want to see what Owe can do as a Sam this year as well. I think that's important to layer on somebody who's earned, you know, the opportunity, the additional types of opportunities and responsibilities. I'm just not there with Harrison. I think you run the same risk that you had with Correa, that he would be less effective because of the multi-positional thing. It's just some players it works for and some players it doesn't. And you know, I don't think it's worked for Tyree Phillips either. I think he'd have been better to have one position that he was focusing on from the very beginning, and he'd do better in that regard. And outside linebacker, inside linebacker, very, very different positions. I mean, don't kid yourself that because they both have the words line and backer in there that they're significant, that they're similar at all.
No, we've been down this road with Correa. That's a great name, yeah. Kamala Correa. That's a great name to bring back. That did not go well.
Yeah. All right, how about another goal for Harrison this year?
Oh, man, I'd like to see him get back in there and become a regular part of the rotation at inside linebacker, like you said, whether it's Mike or Will. I don't lean strongly, you know, one way or the other, but I'd just like to see him have kind of a regular presence in there. In terms of like a great, I know we're not at that point, but for me, I'd like, hey, if you can take over that role, mm-hmm. if you can take over that role where, okay, yeah, they re-sign Bynes for another year, but maybe if Bynes kind of recedes more into almost an on-the-roster coaching role because you're playing mm-hmm. so well next to Patrick Queen that they can keep you out there for the majority of the snaps. I'd love to see that. I mean, that would be awesome if he could get there.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, that obviously do. He's really got a lot of specific things on the football field he needs to improve before you get there, though. I mean, his play speed needs to improve. His recognition needs to improve. I mean, these are a lot of the same things that are frankly are the bugaboos of Patrick Queen. His block shedding needs to improve. His tackling needs to improve. And he also needs to do something to recognize what's going on as a coverage guy in terms of what's going on between level two and level three, whether that means he's just a lane impeder, you know, he's only really a good contributor in zone defense, whether it means, you know, he just comes up and hits somebody who's on a shallow crossing route. He knows to do that. I'd love for him to make some contribution as a pass defender. But honestly, it's just there are a lot of things. And I think right now he needs a focused role to have any hope of really, let me put it this way. From my outsider position, it looks like a focused role would give him the best chance to solve some of these problems for the position he's playing.
Yeah, and I'm hoping Mike McDonald can provide that for him. I did a bunch of reading on him a couple of months ago, just any article I could find about what people were saying about him in Michigan, what his players were saying, other coaches, whoever. And one thing I can't remember was a player. I don't remember who said it, but he said that one thing that he really does, maybe it wasn't a player because a player wouldn't talk like this, but somebody said one of the things that McDonald did really well was he found as many entry points to playing time for players as possible. Mm-hmm. So that defined role that you're talking about, I kind of read in between the lines when they said entry points. But that defined role, that's how I took that. It's like, okay, he's going to find ways to get guys on the field. And maybe that means you can do one, maybe two things. You do those mm-hmm. things really, really well. And I'm going to find a way in some packages for you to do those one or two things just so you can get on the field.
Well, you know me as a believer in very specialized defense, who loves that notion of platooning at inside linebacker at both spots as needed, would take the role of green dot away from either of those positions, that I'm going to love that kind of thing. So I hear that. I'm all kinds of thumbs up on McDonald. By the way, that's a great potential show. I love to pick your brain on that for about a half an hour that becomes an hour of you and me talking about what you know about Mike McDonald in Michigan. It sounds like people would be very interested in that.
Okay, sure.
How about another goal here? I've got plays disciplined positional football, both run and pass.
Yeah, you get an argument from me there. I mean, that would all these things about, you know, defined roles and more playing time. If he does that, if he can do those things, then you're going to have those opportunities, right? If you can demonstrate that you sure. can do that consistently, then you're going to have those opportunities. And I think it's sort of self-fulfilling. I think one thing can feed the other. If you have that more defined role, that can help you become more disciplined.
Oh, yes, in those very areas. Sure.
Right. Yeah. And then as you gain that discipline in those specific areas, maybe they give you one more thing. All right. Next week, we're going to give you one other thing. And then they give you a couple, you know, a game or two to kind of see if you can handle that. And you show you can handle that. So it can grow that discipline in those other areas. But it's almost like, you know, walking before you crawl. Crawling before you walk. Give you, you know, just little bits at a time to kind of help you grow in those areas.
Yeah, I love that. I always love layered responsibilities, just like what you're discussing here. I think that's a good thing. My next thing on the list was develop the ability to know when to gamble. So first of all, I have him playing disciplined positional football and then knowing when to gamble. Obviously, the gambling usually comes second. But I will say this, in watching college tape of inside linebackers, this draft in particular, I became really impressed with a number of guys. Leo Chanel was among them. There's lots of reasons to be impressed with him as a player, but he plays great positional football. Jermaine Johnson, he waited to get drafted into the mid-20s, but he's a guy who I thought played really good positional football, in particular a game I watched against Notre Dame, of just, you know, knowing where he was supposed to be and playing with the other defenders on the field. And that'd be something great for Harrison if he could do it.
Yeah, and that, I think you see that, you know, some of that is going to be instinctive. I mean, I know people mm-hmm. kind of don't like that because it's not something you can, you know, really tangibly quantify. Some of that, I think, is just instinctive. We talked about that with Mark Andrews and Lamar. Some of that you just have. But then I think another part of it comes from your understanding of the defense, right? And we've heard Marlon Humphrey talk about that with Mike McDonald, how he came in and, you know, the early part of the season before they really got on the field, he was explaining to them why he made certain calls. Right. Okay. We're in this group of calls. Let's say we're in our cover two calls, our cover two, cover four calls. Why do we make these calls in these situations? Not just here's the individual call. You play this, you play that. It was a big mm-hmm. picture of here's why I call that in these situations so that the players could have that big picture understanding of, and I have to give credit to Denard Melton. I know you've had Denard on the show, mm-hmm. But Denard mentioned what that does for players. He says, now that gives you more opportunities to gamble. Because right. now you understand the concept and you know not only where you're supposed to be on an individual call, you also can more quickly recognize, hey, when A happens, I know I'm supposed to go here. But when B happens, because I understand why we're making this call in this situation, I can go and jump that route.
Yeah. Even though
that's not my play because I understand where the other players on the defense are going to be.
That's a really, really fascinating point there. And I'll say this, that there's going to be a set of players that really appeals to. I bet that appeals to Kyle Hamilton, to Marlon Humphrey, to any number of the safeties probably that they might have, including guys who play strong safety and, you know, want to know about that. It may not appeal to a defensive lineman in the same way because he's making a more limited set of reads. I just went to an event where Tony Siragusa was on stage talking about the Super Bowl 35 win. And he got absolutely trashed. Right? It was basically a night of Siragusa and Sharp making a lot of jokes, telling a lot of old stories about things, and, you know, him being angry with Phil Simms. Great, great stuff. It was really fun to watch. But he got trashed by the defensive coaches, and there were two of them there, Del Rio and Lewis, for not really knowing the playbook. He knew his own responsibilities, but he didn't really know the playbook.
I need to know about what's going on behind me. I don't need to know that.
There you go. So, you know, it's like, you know, how am I going to use that to gamble? And there's other players who probably, you know, really want to, you know, it's just too broad for them to take in. I mean, they're struggling to learn their own responsibilities within a package. But then there's other players, you know, who the game of football is only so complicated, as Brian Billick used to say. And you know, yeah, this is another layer to add on to that. And I think, you know, we saw Ray Lewis get there in his career and really be a guy who understood that concept and how he could it made him, you know, impact plays in the passing lanes the way that a lot of other inside linebackers couldn't, even after he lost a lot of his speed and mobility.
Yeah, and I think they've got, you mentioned some of those guys, and I think they've got guys who came to the team that way. Marcus Peters is when I heard mm-hmm. that was the first guy that I thought of. I'm like, he already plays that way.
Yeah.
So he might not even need anymore. He might have enough of that already. But you allow other people around him to play the way that he plays, now it's like a cascading effect of the ability to create more turnovers.
Yeah, I'm so excited about the Ravens' ability to create turnovers this year. I can't even say. But let's go to Malik Harrison and what would be a good and great year for him, if that's okay with you, Mike.
Absolutely. You lead the way.
All right, so we'll start with good. I say starting by return to the good graces of the coaches with work ethic, get regular game day activations, be available as a two-down inside linebacker, Mike or Will, who could play rotationally. And even if he doesn't see the field regularly in 2022, prove to the coaches that he's a player for the 2023 plan. So that's a big ask if he doesn't really see the field, because he'll be entering year four. There's a lot of desire to cut that guy entering year four, because you get a chance to reset the clock with a rookie if you've got one. So, you know, whether they would draft somebody or whether they would, have a UDFA that they liked.
It would be a very humbling situation to be in, but you literally would have to just go out there and just play your, you know what, off on special mm-hmm. teams every single snap. I mean, just like your life depends on it, because your football mm-hmm. life in some ways kind of might
depend on it. Yeah. I mean, his next station is going to be some team that can accept who he is, probably has a problem at inside linebacker, thinks he's a chance, but he's not even guaranteed a roster spot there. If he's cut, after his fourth year, going to the fifth year, he's going to be making a vet min salary. He's going to have to try and make a team, and no guarantees.
Nope. I always hold people to the co-cap standard on special teams. He knew what he was. Anthony Levain knew what he was, mm-hmm. and he knew kind of what he was going to be on the team. And, you know, obviously, you know, he got some more opportunities to play defensive snaps for a couple of years there and play really well. But I think he always mm-hmm. knew kind of what his value to the team was. And so there was never any drop in effort because, oh, I should be playing more defensive snaps. I showed what I can do. No. This is what it's going to be. And they're never going to have a reason to say, hey, we can't keep this guy around anymore. Because, look, we had him in the special teams role, and now he's not even giving great effort there. No, he never gave them a reason to do that until, you know, obviously I think injuries and time, you know, catches up to everybody. But when he was healthy and kind of in his prime, that's the standard. You've got to play that way and say, look, if it just doesn't work out and they decide to move on, contractual reasons, whatever, then that's what it is. But it won't be because of anything that I put on tape.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Levine's end came finally because I think the Ravens have too many guys that contribute defensively. In Stone and Jefferson added to the, you know, the big three in addition. And, you know, unfortunately, there just isn't room for him. And I am so happy they've got a place for him within the organization. He's the guy you want to keep around. That attitude, that, you know, I want him out there on the field, whether his job is scouting or whatever it might be. But if I want him out there on the field, talking to young players and instilling that attitude in them. By the way, it's kind of a given by most people that Tony Jefferson is going to take over that special teams captaincy role. Do you think that also makes him the personal protector on the punt team?
I think it could. The reason I hesitate is I'd have to dig into this to look. Obviously, he's played special teams throughout his career, various mm-hmm. you know, percentages. Has he ever played that position? Has he ever played?
Nobody has on the Ravens other than Levine forever. So that's the problem, is that, you know, the opportunity doesn't come until it comes.
Yeah.
And then when it does, you better know what you're doing and better be able to align people properly.
He does seem like the logical guy to do that. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. Let's go back to Harrison here for a great year. Plays well when called upon at the mic or will, and the quality of his play as opposed to injury, that's an important distinction I'm making, demands additional playing time. So he carves out a role that secures his 2023 roster position with defense alone, not even considering his special teams contributions.
Yeah, because the injury part of that, that's like life preserver, right? Okay, we're throwing you in there because we got nobody else, right? You're the best next option. And then when you're no longer the best next option, then you're back on the sideline standing next to me. You don't want that, right? You don't want that to be the reason. You want it to be, as you said, because you've earned it through playing time. Hey, we've got some other options that are healthy, but quite frankly, you're playing and practicing more consistently than they are. So we're going to keep you in there.
Yeah, and it's on this team, which has a lot of options that they have considered ahead of Malik Harrison in the past, it's important that he really earn it over players like Welch and whatnot. But even just doing that is not enough, in my opinion, to secure a 2023 roster position. If he was the best remaining choice in case of injury, he's still in trouble next year, entering year four.
Agreed.
All right, Michael. Just always a world of fun talking football with you, my friend. I want to do more of this. I want to see if we can, get something going on a more regular basis, if that's possible. But certainly we'll always have you on as a guest whenever you'd like to spend time with us. Tell folks where they can read your work.
Well, let's see. You can always, interact with me on Twitter at Abukari. That's at Abukari. Do a couple other podcasts/YouTube shows, Deep Cover Podcast. You can just search it on YouTube. You'll find it there, or any of your podcast apps that you like to listen to. And the Fire Zone Show with Denar Melton, who I mentioned a little while ago. We just did a show a week or two ago with Coach DC. His first name's Derek. I don't know his last name.
Yeah.
But he goes by, it's like all_22.
Yeah, we had him on.
Yeah, yeah. So we had him on, and we looked at the Michigan-Georgia game, looked at the Orange Bowl game, just from a defensive perspective, just to kind of – I do what I always do when we have guests on that show. I mean, Denard is a former player and coach. DC is a former coach. I just sit back, and I drive the film, and I let those guys talk about what they see and kind of conceptually why they think certain things are happening. So that was something we did last week, I think, and that's still out there on YouTube. You can just search the Fire Zone Show channel, and that'll probably be the most recent video. So that's it. And then, of course, I'll still be doing, a variety of different charting projects, which, as you know, never really see the light of day. I just do it, and people are like, why are you doing this if you don't publish them anywhere? It's all for the pursuit of knowledge. That's it, for gaining and understanding knowledge. So that's why I do it. Plus, I love it. It's fun.
I'll tell you what, Michael, you're a very impressive human in general, but the thing I'm probably most impressed by is how much of a journey to self-improvement guy you have. And Michael's a contract lawyer, and I don't think he comes from any sort of background like this. So his first analysis that, I got a chance to look at because he brought it to me, but I learned since that, you're learning how to code in Java so you can do some of these things, got up. So very impressive that you're doing that. I at my age, learning new things gets more and more difficult, as we go. So continuing the same charting, that's one thing, but I'm impressed.
It hasn't been easy. I've gotten some help from some other people. Yoshi 2052 on Twitter. He's much more comfortable in terms of programming and stuff like that. And he's like, look, you got to treat it the same way you treat your charting. You can't do it for a couple of days a week and then take 2 weeks off. Doesn't work that way. You got to do it consistently. You don't have to do it for large chunks of time. You don't have to do it for 5-6 hours a day. Maybe you do an hour, but you got to do it every day to really see improvement and build upon what you're doing. And he knows I've yet to like really commit to doing that. So I still got to do that.
All right. Other folks out there, if you're looking to do a film study short, this is the time of year I love to have the microphone open. I'd like to talk to you as many people as possible, meet some new friends. And send me DMs are open on Twitter. Send me a narrow top if you can, something we discuss in about 25, 30 minutes. If it goes long, that's always okay. We don't have any time constraints on this show. But love to hear from you. I'll get back to you very quickly. Michael, thanks again for coming on.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Ken. Always a good time.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.